The following is an AI reading of my blog called Rich People Don't Have to Pay Taxes. It is for people who don't have time to read blogs and can listen to podcasts though. So, let's go!
The core of this text is a thought experiment, not science. It's perfectly acceptable if you disagree with it. I found this thought experiment to be an interesting take on an eternally debated topic, inequality. First, let's cover some basics. The income gap might be growing, but what we know for sure is that society's wealth distribution follows the so-called Pareto distribution. 20% of people own 80% of the wealth. The specific numbers may vary. Not many people realize this distribution isn't like a typical bell curve, such as human height. Furthermore, it is fractal. In practical terms, this means that if you envy others' wealth when you're poor, you'll still envy them when you're rich. If you were to become part of the 20% who own 80% of a country's wealth, you'd likely be in the 80% owning only 20% of your cohort's wealth, and you could envy that top 20% just as much as before. Who creates technological progress? I don't believe inequality is necessarily a bad thing. One reason for this viewpoint is that wealth is created from above rather than from below. Poor individuals typically use all of their resources just to survive. On the other hand, a wealthy person can afford to purchase new technology, like a cell phone or a medical treatment. What may be considered a luxury today will likely become commonplace in the future. For instance, I'm unsure how much John Adams would have paid for modern dental care in the 18th century, but even George Roman III did not enjoy the kind of dental care that is now standard around most parts of the world. To clarify, my discussion here isn't about who physically manufactured items like the iPhone or dental tools. The origin of these products didn't start at a Chinese factory in Shenzhen where they were made or completed. Instead, it began with individuals who took risks and believed the upper middle class would buy their creations. This process ultimately drives innovation that indirectly benefits even those who did not contribute to its production. Now let's return to taxes and understand why rich people often avoid paying them. There are two main factors at play: policy influence and tax optimization opportunities. In a democracy, politicians need votes for their election campaigns. These can be easily bought with money through means like billboards or targeted political propaganda using modern technology. A successful politician converts the right words spoken to the right people into votes during elections. One reason I don't care about what a politician says in their campaign is that they're only aiming to get votes and not presenting a vision for the future. Unfortunately, the poor will often end up forming coalitions. Even Obama, who served as Commander-in-Chief of the United States Armed Forces for 8 years, was unable to end the war in Iraq despite his speeches. In fact, the number of bombs dropped during his administration reached a new record. Of course, those financing political campaigns expect something in return, and securing certain backdoors, whether within legislation or the judicial system that allow them to avoid paying taxes, is an easy deal for them. These backdoors aren't available to everyone and often come with high fixed costs. Premature optimization. A friend and I were having brunch in Singapore. He also invited two of his friends who faced a super tricky task. They needed to get to Russia within a few days for an important meeting with an investor, but didn't have the necessary stamp in. This case, referred to as a visa, according to all official statements, obtaining this magical stamp takes 30 days and cannot be expedited. If this were the market, it would not allow such inefficiency, but in fact, it is subject to the market. Visas are issued by embassies, and even the Russian ambassador is just an ordinary corruptible civil servant. There are several such ambassadors in neighboring countries with the right stamp, and a courier who can deliver passports and cash in an envelope. As we were having breakfast, our acquaintances were doing a competition to see which ambassador could put the right stamp on a passport for how much money and how many hours. The impossible turned into the possible. Meanwhile, my friend and I have been discussing the topic of tax optimizations. I asked him about whether Singapore is really a tax haven, how much tax he pays, and then we got philosophical about how we think the tax optimization system works. Neither of us had enough experience. In the meantime, our fellow brunchers found a stamp supplier, arranged for a courier to deliver their passport in a couple of hours and bring it straight back to them, and booked their flights to Moscow. Since they were experienced businessmen, we asked them about tax optimization. The instructions were simple: first, make a lot of money. Second, buy an I don't want to pay taxes service on the market from one of the many consulting firms that provide this service. Then they started kind of laughing that first, the startup entrepreneurs come up with a sophisticated tax optimization scheme that costs thousands of dollars, and then nobody buys their product. First, you need to focus on the product you're selling, and then, if you feel like you would be paying too much tax, someone can solve it. I haven't gotten around to making too much money in my life since then, but this story brought me closer to the just-in-time optimization approach in both of its levels. How does it relate to size? Many companies focus on growth before they even have a product or service that anyone wants to buy. They try to solve the problem of producing a million parts, rather than being able to sell just one part first. This is like setting up a call center before having any paying customers. Moving on, let's talk about tax optimization. A janitor or a primary school teacher who works for the state has minimal opportunities to optimize their taxes. However, a taxi driver can more easily avoid reporting income, but once it's recorded on the meter, they have a hard time generating enough expenses. Interestingly, services like Uber significantly reduce the opportunity to hide income when an Uber driver receives money directly to their bank account from Uber. They cannot claim that they didn't receive it, unlike cash in their pocket. In contrast, entrepreneurs with several dozen companies across different countries have much greater possibilities for tax optimization. He can generate income in countries where it is not taxed, use various trusts, and so on. These schemes have some fixed costs, for example, setting up offshore companies, but the wealthy entrepreneur has various legal fictions through which he can deduct costs. Why can't ordinary people deduct costs? Because they are employed. Here I would like to mention that there are countries where a person does not need to be employed and can just invoice their work. In such cases, they can deduct tax-deductible expenses from their tax base. Most people do not understand tax optimization at all. Mainstream newspapers often say that a Slovak company is owned by a shell company from Cyprus, implying it doesn't pay taxes. However, a Slovak company, with some exceptions, pays income tax in the country where it generates income, which is Slovakia, and then pays this taxed income to the owner in Cyprus. The goal of these schemes is likely to conceal the true owner, once the state prohibits doing this, which would significantly limit international business. There will be a highly profitable organization of nominee owners. Another possible use could be to reduce taxes on the sale of a company, but that's an uncommon situation. I believe these two reasons alone demonstrate that if a wealthy person doesn't want to pay taxes, they won't pay them. However, this isn't the promised thought experiment yet. These are just the typical and obvious explanations. A thought experiment. Let's discuss why even affluent individuals who wish to pay taxes and don't optimize or bribe politicians typically end up paying minimal taxes. The reason lies in the structure of prices and money production. Most people assume that a business pays something akin to income taxes and levies on dividends, among others. However, for an entrepreneur, the taxes paid are just another expense similar to materials, rent, and so forth. Any increase in taxes will eventually be incorporated into pricing. One reason for this may be due to consistent margins across various industries. Discussions about industry-specific margins are quite common among business owners operating in different sectors. Upon conversing with competitors, I observed that the operating margin within our industry was strikingly similar, even without prior agreement. We reached a consensus on this matter. A possible explanation for such uniformity is the varying risk factors present in profit across industries. Risk serves as an expense but is not tax-deductible, leading to significant portions of the margin being allocated towards various types of risks, such as demand reduction, input price fluctuations, legal concerns, and shifting environments. Consequently, I believe that entrepreneurs aim for a more stable return on capital following taxation, rather than relying solely on profit. If this statement holds true, then income tax becomes an expense that contributes to the overall price of goods and services. Businesses don't pay taxes themselves, they simply collect them. In my opinion, the income tax isn't actually paid by the company that generates the revenue, but rather by the final customer. However, this assumption is not essential for this idea to be accurate. It's enough to understand that companies make money by selling their products and services, so every dollar they earn comes from the end consumer. To pay income tax, a business must first collect it from the consumer. If there's no profit, no taxes are paid. Ultimately, the funds used to cover taxes originate from the consumer's pocket, not the wealthy entrepreneur. The entrepreneur does declare the taxes and submit them to the government, but in reality, it's the consumer who has paid for them. On one hand, income tax accounts for approximately 1 to 2% of a company's sales. As a result, eliminating income tax would likely have little impact on reducing prices. However, it would encourage competition since income tax represents a significant portion of the return on capital. But this principle doesn't apply to other taxes that consumers pay. For instance, value-added tax VAT in Europe constitutes around 1/5 of the end product's price. Additionally, excise taxes on gasoline form a substantial part of its cost, which is also reflected in the prices of goods purchased by individuals who walk everywhere someone needs to transport. Those tomatoes to the marketplace, in my opinion, the belief that taxes are paid by wealthy companies, is misguided. Ultimately, they're funded by consumers like you and me who utilize these companies' services. What is interesting from this point of view is that a company that optimizes taxes well can then give us better prices and make even more money because they have lower prices, but they have more customers because of them, so tax optimization is a competitive advantage. People usually perceive firms that tax optimize as immoral, but the interesting insight is precisely that they actually inadvertently provide us with a better service unless they have some other, e.g., monopoly advantage secured by a state license, a state guaranteed patent, etc. Let that sink in for a moment, even if you don't fully believe it. Just for the sake of a thought experiment, try assuming that all taxes are paid by end consumers. Consumption structure. To understand why poor people pay the most taxes on their production, it is important to understand what poor, middle class, whatever that may be, and rich people do with their wealth. A poor individual uses up all their earnings on necessities, referred to as a shopping basket, which varies for each person. This is why the official government measurement of inflation, based on the rise in consumer price index, isn't accurate. They spend their income on food they don't grow themselves, rent, utilities, healthcare and education for their children. These individuals live hand-to-mouth, not saving for future needs, essentially consuming everything. In this hypothetical scenario, all value-added taxes, consumption taxes, and income taxes are paid by the consumers. This implies that nearly 100% of their production is converted into consumption and subsequently taxed. Now consider a wealthy person who is considerably richer than the poor individual, say, 1,000 times more prosperous. Wealth distribution in society follows the Pareto principle, but stomach volume continues to follow a Gaussian distribution. It's assumed that there isn't a strong correlation between wealth and stomach volume. The rich person's consumption is limited by their physical capacity. After acquiring 3 mansions, 6 cars, 2 yachts, and 1 private jet, their wealth mostly consists of investments shares in companies whose income taxes are paid by customers, gold which isn't taxable until resold, commodities, bonds, bitcoins, and similar assets. Their direct consumption remains relatively low compared to total assets. Investments comprise a higher percentage of the rich person's wealth or income than that of a poor individual. As for daily expenses, they're significantly lower in relation to overall resources. One crucial aspect is the creation of money, an often overlooked tax. It's quite unpredictable and can be experienced, for instance, within Slovakia's IT sector. Due to EU funding programs, €1 billion have been allocated to the IT sector. Although it hasn't resulted in an influx of new programmers, despite rumors about first-year university students becoming senior programmers overnight, it has at least tripled the number of existing professionals. This indicates that while the supply of programmers remains relatively steady, the demand for their services has grown significantly. These funds represent newly printed money entering the economy, as opposed to income generated through production. As a result, programmers have experienced an increase in earnings recently, not because they are producing more, but rather due to the government's decision to inject this fresh newly printed cash into the IT sector instead of other industries like agriculture, agricultural subsidies being a separate issue. Consequently, programmers can now afford luxuries such as new iPhones, better tomatoes, and improved housing. So, indirectly, they also raise house prices, although these are rising thanks to newly printed bad money flowing into real estate and the construction sector via mortgages. This effect of rising prices and the implications for business is described very well by Richard Mayberry in his book Clipper Ship Strategy. But the bottom line is that most people think that the new money is coming into the economy at a steady rate. That is very easy to disprove. The M1 money supply in November 2016 was 7,156,510 million. At the end of 2015, a little over 6 million million. The euro is used by about 337 million Europeans. I assume you didn't notice that between 2015 and 2016, you got 71,565,106,337 = 3,431 from the government. If I took the M3 stock as a proxy, it would be roughly €1,514. If some government official or central bank employee knocked on your door and handed you this money, please give me their contact details as they must have forgotten about me. But this money went somewhere. Compare that to how much you or any rich person pays in taxes, and it is clear that the effect is far from even. Someone benefits from it, and someone else loses. 1 billion of such money has distorted the Slovak IT sector beyond recognition. Thanks to this, there are activities that fight corruption. The problem is that they want to help by trying to direct this flow of money somewhere else, fairer, better, value for money, etc. It's just that at the heart of the whole distortion is the flow of that money itself. Which is not to say that it's not good to fight corruption, just that if that money is also used in a manner consistent with all morals way, it would still be distributed unequally. Certainly one family of four will not get €6,000 a year M3 increment or €13,600 M1 increment every year. Entrepreneurs, at least those who are successful, are very good at being able to identify this flow of money. The most common use of this money flow involves selling to individuals who receive funds first and purchasing from those who obtain them last, in other words, offering products at higher prices to consumers capable of affording these increased costs, those possessing access to the new euros, and acquiring goods from sellers yet unaware of the updated currency, hence having insufficient time to elevate their own pricing. Holding euros or bonds denominated in euros within an account is likely one of the least effective savings strategies available. This phenomenon will erode wealth at a pace akin to wind blowing sand off a rocky shore. This brings us to consider the middle class, who, despite not owning stakes in companies, stocks, and gold, will still attempt to save for improved housing options. Consequently, while the middle class may not contribute as significantly to consumption taxes, they inadvertently save considerably less than initially believed by depositing funds within an account. They fail to exploit the new money effect and find themselves on its disadvantageous side. For instance, ponder a family endeavoring to save for housing. They store their euros in a savings account that, with some effort, yields a 5% per annum return. Meanwhile, their neighbor obtains a mortgage at 3% interest and acquires a new home. With fewer houses available for purchase, property values increase. Bear in mind that the other neighbor is also constructing homes on a mortgage, causing a shortage of workers, including those who build roads with EU subsidies, and thus cannot construct your house unless offered an attractive wage. What does this imply for the saving family? The prices of the items they are preserving for escalate rapidly, making it more advantageous to access a source of new money loans or euro funds rather than save. This brings us back to the impact of new money. It is not profitable to save or opt to consume less. Instead, latch onto the origin of fresh capital and transfer transfer savings through escalating consumer prices to everyone else. Now imagine I build a house using a mortgage, causing house prices to rise and subsequently increasing the wages for workers involved in its construction. This new influx of money will reach both the workers and the original landowner, potentially leading to an increase in other prices based on their purchases. As a result, consumers of these goods, including houses, land, labor, food, and even alcohol purchased by the workers, may be forced to consume less due to higher costs. In this scenario, everyone saves on my house. It's quite fascinating, isn't it? Now consider this: are poor or middle class individuals more likely to obtain a mortgage? Despite being able to consume fewer goods as prices rise, poor people can still be seen as saving for the houses of wealthier individuals who secure mortgages. Furthermore, mortgages represent just one channel through which wealth flows from lower income populations to the affluent. European Union subsidies serve as another prime example of this phenomenon. The whole thing is invisible, nobody's account balance is going down. Suddenly, a playground or a church in a village gets renovated for free with EU funds, making everyone happy about the European Union. And then we grumble that tomatoes and houses have gone up in price again. Ah, those evil greedy businessmen, don't we? Next time you grumble about higher prices, look at the European Union logo and the words "built with European Union funds." That is the real reason why prices are going up and the poor become poorer. A rich person often has some euros. Cash is king, especially in times of crisis, when a rich person buys everything cheaper that panicking people want to get rid of to cover losses. But a large part of their assets are super money, such as shares of companies or real estate cash flows. And of course, they own buildings, houses, factories, businesses, and cars. Everything is subject to some wear and tear, but rarely as much as inflation. Almost conclusion. In my opinion, the welfare state is not funded by wealthy individuals. It's an illusion that makes people believe rich folks contribute a portion of their earnings to support the less fortunate. I think most taxes and the inflation tax, the impact of creating new money, are paid by those who consume the majority of their income without saving and use the government's subpar currency. To understand this concept, consider thought experiments rather than relying solely on tax returns or account balances. Remember that a single euro today is not equivalent to one 2 years from now. It depends on whom you're selling to, those with access to new money versus individuals selling tomatoes at street markets. Now let's discuss the champagne socialists who are involved in startups from EU funds, enjoying organic specialty coffee, which I also like. At least we share something in common and expressing their indignation towards injustice in the world that rich people should pay taxes. Their stated objective is to increase taxes on wealthy individuals and provide assistance to those less fortunate. However, they fail to grasp the intricacies of tax systems and how new money operates. In fact, since they themselves benefit from this new money, they passionately advocate for progressive taxation, increased income taxes for high earners, and the implementation of dividend taxes. Nonetheless, they remain opposed to what would genuinely be beneficial: the establishment of a fair monetary system, free from government interference or manipulation that favors specific sectors of the economy. Why is this? Simply because it benefits their non-profit organizations receiving grants, as well as startups funded by government startup funds or EU grant programs. So, what steps can we take to address this issue? If you can save something, consider saving it in a form other than fiat money. For different individuals, this may vary. For me, it involves investing in my education and personal development, enhancing my marketable skills, and increasing my knowledge on starting and running a business. The more I learn, the better equipped I am to run my business efficiently in various areas. If you have children, an investment in their health and education is also important. These are returns that no central bank can take away from you. Of course, don't invest your time learning something that will not be needed in the age of technological advancement. This doesn't mean attending a state university to study something useless. Instead, focus on acquiring knowledge or skills that benefit both yourself and others around you. In other words, aim to educate yourself in areas that enable you to help more people, including yourself. Another effective way to save is by storing value in precious metals, for example, gold or silver. First, gold and in bitcoins, consider alternative ways to avoid falling victim to this effect. Reflect on what you are financing and how it impacts your lifestyle choices. We experience disproportionate taxation not just because of ourselves as taxpayers, but also due to our use of bad money, which leads to projects that contradict our values being funded. This issue is not about lack of speaking up or participating in elections. It's about working, buying, and paying for these projects with our taxes. If you believe taxes support orphanages, the poor, and disabled individuals, ask yourself if those millions of new euros will truly reach a homeless person, an orphan, someone with disabilities, or anyone genuinely in need of assistance. Secondly, remember that we do not require more money from any source, whether it be the rich or anyone else. I wish you much optimism, and I suggest you think about what you can do personally, and I don't mean now a campaign, a website, or a political party, but really personally how you can change your behavior to tilt the equation in your favor. If you get richer, if you give yourself the luxury, you will also help me, who have not contributed in any way, because you will be funding progress that benefits us all and the poorest. Disproportionately more, if you want to contribute to society, don't pay taxes you don't have to pay, save, invest and create. And of course, if you want to help those who need help, you don't need the state to do it. I assume you can find those who need help yourself.
Thank you for listening. I'm sorry for any possible quirks generated by the large language model or text-to-speech engine, but I think it is worth transferring these blocks into audio form for people who can't or don't have time to read. So I hope it was useful to you, and I would really appreciate if you used value for value podcasting apps to listen to this episode and stream me some sets or Boost. I read all the comments on the Boosts as well. So if you have any comment about this content, feel free to use Fountain.fm or any other app and boost this podcast. Thank you very much.